Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, December 6th. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And it's the time of the week where we discuss the Division III season. And at this point, of course, it means playoffs, but not just playoffs. Of course, a couple other things of interest that happened last week. Not only, of course, the whittling of the Division III playoff field from 8 teams down to 4, but a couple of other interesting sidelight things. You know, one of the things about this time of year in the postseason is that it's also awards season. So we had the four finalists named for the Gagliardi Trophy this past week, and of course there was a Division III All-Star game of sorts played this past week as well. And before we talked about the four playoff games and the four teams that are remaining, I thought we'd spend a few minutes talking about these things as well, Keith. And for the Gagliardi Trophy, you know, it was whittled down to the final four players from the 10 on the ballot, and Keith, of course, you know, some of the best names in Division III were never on this ballot to begin with, so not being in the final four is no surprise. But it really kind of represents a different tack on the award this year, at the very least.
Yeah, I think based, of course, that sounds like the word of the day this week. Of course. Based on who wins, I think it has to do, it may signal, I guess, a shift in what it means to win the Gagliardi Trophy. And I know that's sort of a conceptual type of thing, but it's been stressed to us as voters over the years that you take the three factors into account. You want to have a complete player, someone who represents Division III on the field and off the field in the classroom and in volunteer work in some kind of exceptional way beyond the field and beyond the classroom. And that's what makes a Gagliardi finalist. And these guys, the four guys we have named here, you know, all fit that criteria, but it's been stressed to us over the years that it is primarily a football award and you want to name the best football player. And some years, you know, that's automatic, whether it's Justin Beaver or, you know, Greg McKaylee or someone like that, where it's, you know, it's almost a no-brainer. And you can go back really through the history of the award and see some of the guys who've won it, and they've been great players as well as, you know, exemplary in the classroom and in volunteer work. But I think this year, you know, if you look at the story of, you know, Matt Hoffman, who's one of the finalists, defensive end for Rowan, who skipped his last game, not even this season, but his junior year, you know, to help save somebody's life who was dying of leukemia, and you know, he donated bone marrow, and that's a real, I mean, that's a touching story, and that's something that you know, if he wins a Gagliardi Trophy, and it's not like he's a bad player, he was a really great defensive end for Rowan, but that's moving in a different sort of way, that it wasn't just the stats that brought you to him. You know, and if he's somebody who wins it, I think he'd be deserving of it. But it would signal a little bit of a shift in what it means to win the Gagliardi Trophy, especially when you consider, you know, who's not nominated for it this season. The four finalists are Matt Hoffman, as I mentioned, from Rowan, the defensive end, Ben McLaughlin, Louisiana College senior quarterback, Kyle Ray, Franklin senior quarterback, who also has a pretty good backstory, and then Eric Watt, another senior quarterback from Trine, who only guy of the four who led his team into the playoffs, and he had a great performance last week, the week before this Saturday against Whitewater, scoring 31 points on them, had that game tied at 31 deep in the fourth quarter. So he's the one, maybe from the on-the-field standpoint, him and Quincy Daniels, for the running back for Mary Harden Baylor, who's not one of the four finalists, but was one of the 10, I guess you call them semifinalists. Those are the two guys in the group who really excelled on the field. And I think that there are some big names missing from the group. You know, if I had to name my top five players, you know, guys I would vote for just for on the field, you know, Cecil Shorts III would certainly be at the top of the list for Mountain Union, the real talented wide receiver for them. And we believe, Pat, that Mountain Union nominated their tight end, Kyle Miller, who's also quite a player, but doesn't put up the gaudy numbers. He may be the best NFL prospect of the entire, you know, Division III group that comes out this year. But he didn't make the 10 finalists or the 10 semifinalists, whatever you might call them. But anyway, so Cecil Shorts is not in the group. Lavelle Coppedge, someone who's, you know, coming off a 2,000-yard season, 35 touchdowns last year, and then has played well this year. Both he and Shorts missed some time with injuries. Shorts missed a handful of games, and Coppedge missed, I think, a game. But those guys still put up numbers, I think, that would compete. And then you have, you know, Daniels and Watt, who I think deserve to be in there. And then maybe Logan Flannery, another guy whose Bethel team is still competing, who would be in the group if we were just talking football only. And if anybody, you know, if you didn't have to depend on your school to nominate you, I think those may be, you know, your top five guys. In any case, we have the four that we have. And I think if Matt Hoffman wins or if Kyle Ray wins, you know, it may signal a shift to mean, you know, you when you win the Gagliardi Trophy, the three factors are more equal now. You know, that's not just a good player. It really does heavily weight the classroom and the volunteer work. I think if Ben McLaughlin wins it, the Louisiana College quarterback, it's just a look. It's probably due mostly to his gaudy numbers. You know, Louisiana had that wide-open offense and great passing attack, one of the best ones in the country this season. And, you know, he led his team within a whisker of the playoffs. So, but I think, you know, you have to remember who's on the committee. It's all people with Division III affiliation, but it's not people who necessarily follow the games every week. So I think, you know, Ben McLaughlin has a chance to be the winner in terms of, you know, because of the numbers he put up. And maybe it ends up being Eric Watt, who I think is probably the guy out of the four finalists who was the, you know, he led his team the deepest into the playoffs and it was maybe the best player. But certainly this group of finalists, when you factor it in with the fact that Blaine Westermeyer won it last year, he's a tackle from Augustana, I think it signals a little bit of a shift in what it means to win the Gagliardi Trophy. And I'm sorry I talked about it for 5 minutes, but it is kind of a big deal.
Well, you know, and the thing is too, Keith, it's the public perception of the award is going to continue to be that this is the Division III Heisman Trophy, but you know, really it isn't. When we sit down in the next week and a half or so and discuss who the D3Football.com Offensive Player of the Year is, you know, none of these four guys is going to be really up for discussion. None of the 10 really would be up for discussion. I think that a couple of the names that have already been mentioned will be people we'll talk about. You know, someone else who isn't in the finalists and or in the 10 finalists and not really sure if he was nominated. For example, Aaron Bomey of Linfield, I think, would have made a fine candidate, certainly on football merits. Neither you nor I has access to his GPA or knows what the community service aspect looks like. And you know, yeah, we can project kind of by process of elimination that if Mountain Union nominated somebody, it was probably Kyle Miller. You know, Kyle Miller is a very, very strong shot at being the first team All-American at tight end, but I don't know how many tight ends win Offensive Player of the Year awards either. It does seem like, however, that it's not going to change how people think about this award, and especially since the Once Upon a Time Melberger Award used to fulfill that role and hasn't really done it in the most of the past decade now. There's really still a hole, I think, in Division III awards.
Yeah, Pat, in fact, you simplified it probably the best possible way that it could be simplified. Is if we're reviewing the Gagliardi Trophy race the way Division I folks view the Heisman Trophy, it's usually just the offensive player who does the most for his team, whether it's the best player on the best team. And if you follow Division I this year, it would be, I guess, Cam Newton of Auburn. And I don't even know who else would be up for it besides him. You know, that would be when you talk about you'd bring the Linfield quarterback in, the obviously Shorts, the talented wide receiver for Mountain Union, the top running back for Whitewater. You know, those are all guys who would be some of the best players on the best teams. And, that would certainly make sense if that's how it were. But it seems like over the past few years, the trophy has shifted a little bit to more evenly weight all three of those factors: the football component, the classroom component, and then the volunteer work component. And that doesn't make it a good thing or a bad thing. It's just an observation that we're making here. And maybe somebody else will come along, you know, the next Greg McKaylee type guy. He's the guy that always jumps off the top of my head because he was a you know, physics major and all this stuff, and also the quarterback of a national championship caliber team, which kind of worked out perfectly for him to be a Gagliardi Trophy type of guy.
One postseason honor that made a nice step forward this year, I think, was the D3 Senior Classic. This is an all-star game. It took place in Salem, Virginia, back on Friday night, December 3rd. Last year was the first time that this thing was put together. It kind of seems like the rosters might have been a little hastily assembled. I'm not sure that if you sat down and really scrutinized last year's roster, that it was really all-star quality. And this year, you know, is certainly a step in the right direction. There's a lot of ways in which the game and the publicity of it and the administration of it perhaps could improve, but they certainly did some things better this time around.
Yeah, I think, Pat, the thing that really jumped out to me was watching the fourth quarter of that game. You know, when Justin Feaster led Feaster was on the South team. He led his team to the go-ahead drive with, you know, about 2 minutes left. And then Jay Caron turned around, you know, the Pomona Pizza quarterback, and led his team back down the field, and they kicked the game-winning field goal. You could really see the enthusiasm and the kids cared about winning, you know, and that's a good sign because, you know, we've written about all-star games before, and some of them are good experiences and some of them are negative experiences and some of them are just, you know, you go and it's in a cool city and you meet, guys that you have something in common with and you enjoy it, but the game is kind of lacking. And I didn't get the sense from watching that the players felt that way at all. And, you know, you had a couple of pretty good coaches in there and Tony Iruli from Maryville. And then of course, Mike DeLong, who coached the winning team. So, you know, that helps to have a couple of good coaches on staff, to lead the two teams. But it really did seem like, I think that there was, it mattered to the players. And as long as it matters to the players, you know, the game is in fairly good shape. Now, Pat, you and I, you know, we tweeted some of our instant reactions to the game. And, you know, there were some things, I think, that I don't know if bugged us is the right word, but, you know, we recognize where the game still has, you know, a way to go to be a really great representative game for Division III in terms of it being the ideal all-star game. And it may never be that. And you know, it's easy for us to sit back and criticize when we never put together our own all-star game. You know, it's harder than it looks. I think a couple things, you know, are keeping it right now from being the perfect representative all-star game for Division III. You know, I think as long as it's pay for play, you'll always have people who won't either have the money or have the interest in paying to go to an all-star game. Whereas if it was, you know, however that could be done, if it was taken care of, you know, you could select the best teams and fly them all in and play it. And I think it's always going to be tough too if it's a couple weeks before the Stag Bowl. You know, this is it's a pretty good time of year because there's still interest in the game during, you know, this past week. It was the round of eight. There were enough teams eliminated where most guys could get there. But still, you have eight teams in action that have a duty to their college team, which means they're not going to be able to play in an all-star game on December, you know, 5th or 3rd or whenever it ends up falling in future years, that first week of December. They do have it in Salem, which is great because that's title town for Division III. And, you know, it's somewhere where the infrastructure is in place, you know, the stadium they're familiar with. And they were able to get the game on TV this year, which I thought was a huge, huge step. Not only was it broadcast live online, Pat, and I noticed you made the remark that the online broadcaster seemed to be in touch with D3 a little better than the TV guys, but it was on a Fox affiliate, which got it on DirecTV, which I thought was great because, you know, we didn't have to, you know, if you were traveling somewhere for one of Saturday's quarterfinal games, you could still catch this game, you know, somehow at home on Friday, and that made it really cool. So I think, you know, it's not going to be the perfect game if it's this week, the round of eight, because, you know, no Mountain Union players, no Whitewater, Wesley, Mary Harden, Baylor, North Central, all these great teams, Bethel, St. Thomas, none of those players were able to play in the game. But for what it is, it must be doing pretty well because the players were real enthusiastic about winning when the North team kicked that field goal at the end of the game.
And Keith, you know, the two quarterbacks, and they were the only two quarterbacks selected who were there. You mentioned Justin Feaster from Hardin-Simmons, Jacob Caron from Pomona-Pitzer. I would have liked to have seen you know, some of the people we've talked about already, Kyle Ray from Franklin, you know, Eric Watt from Trine, you know, those are guys who, you know, who were available at the very least, you know, and again, you mentioned pay for play and certainly, you know, a quick turnaround for, for Trine from a second round loss might have, made it a little bit difficult to get into this, but I thought just the one quarterback thing was odd and, you know, the fact that, the South nearly won the game on a touchdown scored by a kid who plays in the NAIA and is not a Division III player. You know, there were just all sorts of things all over the place, none of, you know, which we really know anything about because they haven't really said anything about it. But, you know, those were just some of the oddities that that we pointed out. And you could go back and read through the Twitter feeds for both of us if you can get back to Friday night and see more about that. And it's probably, you know, now we're pretty far into this podcast, and we haven't mentioned in any detail any of the four games that happened on Saturday, in which Mount Union defeated Alfred 37-7 to advance to the national semifinals. Wesley beat Mary Hardin Baylor 19-9. Bethel beat St. Thomas 12-7, and Whitewater beat North Central 20-10. Keith, I figured I'd start with Whitewater North Central since that's the game I was at, and it was a number one versus number five, which not that any. Not that any quarterfinal game in a national playoff needs any extra emphasis, but two top five teams meeting in this round of the playoffs, and in a game, Keith, where it came down to the last minute, but as it's gone for Whitewater through the playoffs, Whitewater had a strong second half and especially a strong fourth quarter to pull out the 20-10 victory.
And I think that's right now what makes Whitewater different than any other team in the country, with the exception of Mount Union. Is that they have that strong offensive defensive line. They like to run the ball. They can throw it up and down the field. One of the Gagliardi Trophy finalists that we didn't mention much was Aaron Roush, the Whitewater wide receiver, and he's quite a player. They have skill players that can play, but when they need to buckle down and finish a drive, they can do that on offense. And then on defense, I think they're tough to score on, and they generate turnovers. They don't turn it over on offense. Lee Brecky, who's the backup quarterback and has started the three playoff games for them, he threw an interception on Saturday, which was only the second interception that Whitewater threw all year. And then they generated three key turnovers there in the second half when that game was close and North Central actually led, I think, late in the third quarter, 10-7, and Whitewater was able to turn that game on a couple of turnovers, including a big one, Pat, that I'm sure when you saw it happen, it was a pretty huge play.
Well, there's a couple of them that qualifies. There's one in particular. Luke Hibner, the defensive lineman for Whitewater, actually generated two takeaways in the fourth quarter. One is picking up a fumble in which Spencer Stanek was it started on a I think a third down and 23 or somewhere in that vicinity, and was struggling to get extra yardage after going about 10 yards or so on his run, and just had the ball pop out and Hibner pounced on it. But the other one, Hibner is not the biggest guy. He's not the tallest guy, I should say, on the Whitewater defensive line. They've got a couple guys who are 6'3 and 6'4. He's listed at only 6'1, but he goes up and he first of all tips the ball out of the air and basically bats it to himself, runs it 43 yards down to about the 4 yard line, where Whitewater at that point being up 17-10, and North Central had the ball at midfield with about it was inside of 3 minutes. Whitewater was more intent on running out the clock at that point and just coming away with some points to make it a two-possession game rather than really, I think, trying to pound it necessarily into the end zone. So they settle for a 19-yard field goal, go up 20-10, and that's the way the game ends. Keith, one of the things that Doug Rothschild, who was doing color on the game with me, and he's a CCIW guy, mentioned is that Whitewater put North Central in a position where it had not been all year, needing a fourth quarter score, a drive and a score in order to win the football game, and they'd not really been behind in that kind of situation before. And when you started talking about that's one of the things that Whitewater does, that was the first thing that popped to mind was Whitewater's been in that position now, needing scores late in the game, actually, frankly, each of the last 3 weeks, and they've continued to come through.
Yeah, and you know, you can probably go further back than that. You can go even into the regular season where they have, you know, they get a tight game every now and again in the WIAC, and that's turns out to be good for them down the road. You know, it's those challenges. Coaches always like to have those challenges when they win them, and then when they lose, they're like, oh, you know, we play too tough a schedule. But I think for Whitewater, it's worked out great for them this year because they got a little bit of a push from Stevens Point. And you know, it's funny, the reason they were on the road on Saturday was because their strength of schedule wasn't high enough among the six undefeated top-notch teams that were looking for number one seeds. And so Whitewater ended up getting one of the number two seeds, even though they're universally recognized as the number one team in the country. And a lot of people took issue with that. But it turns out the Whitewater schedule and the three playoff games that they've played, where it knocked them down into that two-hole where they had to play Franklin, they had to play Trine, and then had to play North Central, they're really well battle-tested now. And I'm sure part of it is because they've been without their starting quarterback. But part of it, too, is now if they're going forward and they have to play Wesley this week and they have to play the winner of Mount Union and Bethel in the Stag Bowl, you know, assuming they beat Wesley, and either of those games is close, they've now been through that several times. They're going to be calm and collected in close game. They know they'll stick together offensively and defensively, won't panic, and that could bode really well for them.
You know, and getting eyes on Matt Blanchard this week and trying to figure out, you know, what his status is. He looked good in warmups again. You know, I did some as much nosing around as I could off the record, and you know, the responses that were coming back to me were, you know, basically that there was a mystery. They didn't really know what was going on, and these were people who were in position to know you know, what's going on with Matt Blanchard. So, you know, what his availability is, who seems to know. You know, Brecky looked pretty good on Saturday. His numbers don't really show it. He was 9 of 16 passing. They basically practically didn't throw the ball at all in the entire second half. They basically put the ball in Lavelle Coppedge's hands as much as possible. He had 20 yards rushing at halftime or thereabouts, and ended up with 107. You know, he was a big part of the third and fourth quarter. And you know, the scoring drives for Whitewater down the stretch were all short, but they were fueled by the turnovers. They got the ball on the North Central 19, on the 39, and on the 3, going in all three times. So they also scored with short fields, you know, but the defense put them in position to do that.
Yeah, I'd read somewhere, Pat, where the average starting position for Whitewater over the course of the game was the 49-yard line, and for North Central, it was the 20-yard line, which partially explains why North Central outgained and had more first downs than Whitewater did. The 306 to 253 was the total offense, 17 to 14 on the first downs. So North Central absolutely matched up well with them, played hard, and probably thinks, you know, if it hadn't been for the turnovers, that they would have, you know, won that game. And you know, we maybe have to ask ourselves a question, depending on what happens here in this final round. Is North Central the number three team? Or, you know, are they possibly the number two team in the country? You know, or number four, or number five? They're going to be right there in that mix, because I think when you hang this tough with Wisconsin Whitewater, as voters take a look at their final polls, we'll have to keep North Central in consideration. Pat, you did mention the quarterback situation for the Warhawks. I think from afar, this is what you know, this week, kind of them going back and forth with Blanchard and giving us the hint that he might start on Saturday, and then him not playing at all. And Lee Brecky was 9 of 16 passing. So, Pat, as you mentioned, they didn't use him a whole bunch. You know, they do a great job of tailoring the game plan to who can play. I think we have to really consider the possibility that Blanchard is done, maybe for the year, and either they don't know it, or they're not letting on, they're not telling us. You know, that maybe that Brecky is the guy going forward, and that if Whitewater has to win a national championship with a guy who didn't make a start before the playoffs, that's what they're going to have to do, and they may have to ride Lavelle Coppedge and this great defense the rest of the way. They might be able to do it, Pat, because you know, Coppedge now 29 carries on Saturday, and you know he's been basically getting 30 or more carries the past several weeks, and it seems like that's playing to Whitewater's offensive strength, and then you know just playing the field position game, and depending on that defense plays to that defensive strength.
Yeah, Booker Stanley got just a handful of carries, pretty much all of them on one possession, if I remember correctly, on Saturday. Antoine Anderson didn't get a carry. You know, and we talk about the strong defense. You know, they're definitely very strong up front. The front seven is great. You know, the secondary wasn't necessarily tested a whole lot on Saturday, but they certainly were tested by Franklin and Trine, and struggled a little bit there. So if they're going to continue to contend, they're going to see a team that's capable of throwing the ball this week in Wesley, and then if Mount Union advances past Bethel and Whitewater advances, they would see a team that can throw the ball in the Stag Bowl as well. So moving on to the Mount Union game, Mount Union it beats Alfred 37-7. Keith, I'm not entirely sure what to say about this, except that over the past few weeks, you know, to note that since Cecil Shorts came back from his injury and going down the line here in the playoffs, he's been, you know, basically somebody nobody has an answer for.
Yeah, and you know, there may only be one team alive still in these playoffs that has a cornerback that could potentially match up with Cecil Shorts, and that would be Wesley. So if those two teams met in the Stag Bowl, you know, I'm just trying to think of the teams that I've seen play this year, and that would include Whitewater and Wesley. You know, I don't know. You know, Whitewater, their secondary has been a question mark throughout the playoffs and really throughout the season. And I think if they're going to try to stop Shorts, and this is, of course, getting ahead of ourselves, that they would try to do it with more than one player, with zones and different sort of things. But, you know, Alfred did a nice job in the first half. That was a 10-7 game deep into the second quarter. And Larry Karras, you know, for whoever knocks Mountain Union for supposedly running up scores, you know, and not having any class. Here, it was a real classy quote that Karras had in the post game, where he said basically that it wasn't anything Mountain Union was doing wrong, that Alfred was good on defense and was you know, playing them pretty well. And for, again, we get a little spoiled because of watching Mountain Union dominate over the years. You just expect them to run away with these games. And just because it's a East team, a team that wasn't in the top 25 at the start of the playoffs, you know, you think they can't match up with Mountain Union. Alfred was doing a good job of it for most of the first half. Again, when Tom Secchi hit Josh Phillips with a 34-yard touchdown pass midway through the second quarter, that's a 10-7 football game. And then Mountain Union had to put together a nine-play, 61-yard drive, took about 5 minutes, ended with a Neil Seaman 15-yard touchdown pass to Cecil Shorts to make it 17-7. And they made it 27 real quick before the half. And then they broke it open in the second half. And Nick Driscoll fumble return helped make it 27-7, and they sort of rolled from there. But it wasn't easy for Mountain Union, and we sometimes expect these games to be easy for them because they've been so good, so dominant over the years. You know, this is their 16th straight semifinal appearance. They have 19 conference titles in a row. You know, you get a little spoiled, and it's not always the case.
Yeah, and there's good and bad to pull out of the numbers offensively for Mountain Union / defensively for Alfred. Mountain Union only 4 of 16 on third down conversions, for example. Neil Seaman just a little bit over 50% passing the ball, 20 for 37. But they held on to the ball forever. They had the ball for 38 minutes and 34 seconds. You know, primarily, I think, because Alfred couldn't pass and couldn't run. They ended up with 149 total yards, 27 of them rushing, and then Tommy Secchi was 8 of 33 passing.
Pat, if you look around these four semifinals too, you know, Whitewater giving up the 10 points to North Central was the only team that gave up double digits. Whitewater gave up 10, Wesley gave up 9 points, and then Bethel and Mountain Union only gave up 7 points each. So even when those offenses are sputtering, and it happened in the case of Bethel, it happened for a while for Mountain Union, and certainly Wesley was held way under its you know, points average and its yards average for the season. All the teams still alive can lean on their defenses. So if you want to go the cliche route and say defense wins championships, I think that's borne out the past 2 weeks in the playoffs, especially this week. You know, the scoring defense has been great. If you want to spin it forward a little bit and talk about Bethel and Mountain Union, you know, I don't know which number you pull off this stat sheet for Mountain Union. Do you look at the 430 total yards and say, ah, Mountain Union, you know, and the 37 points, typical game for them? Or do you look at that 4-16 on third down and say Bethel really has a chance here, because Bethel has been an exceptional defensive team all season, and they shut down St. Thomas on Saturday?
They did. You know, St. Thomas was without Ben Wortman, whether by choice or by injury. He'd gotten banged up, I guess, apparently late in the Linfield game, and they didn't give him the ball at all on Saturday. And Fritz Waldvogel, who's the All-American return man and starting wide receiver, number one receiver for the Tommies, got knocked out of the game early on. And they're then resulting in a freshman being the number one receiver. They don't necessarily lose a whole lot without Wortman in the backfield, other than the fact that Colin Tobin has to become a nearly a 30 carry guy, and that's carrying a different load than, you know, being the guy who comes in relief and can carry 15 times for you and have a lot of success. I think a lot of a lot of St. Thomas's struggles start with those two occurrences, I guess, basically. But, you know, then again, Bethel did a lot to shut down St. Thomas on offense in the first meeting as well. And, you know, Waldvogel was certainly healthy. Wortman played, maybe not at his best. I'm not sure how healthy he was that game, but they certainly had a lot more of their offense at their disposal the first time around. And here the second time around, you know, just basically locked down. St. Thomas being held to 220 yards of total offense, 54 yards passing. That's just it's hard to win that way.
Absolutely. And, you know, Bethel did it with 18 yards passing, but that's more their style. The Bethel just wants to, you know, they're going to run the ball, run it some more, and then play great defense. And Pat, you know, you pointed to that very early in the season when you saw a St. Thomas game, and you said, you don't know if St. Thomas has the quarterback and has that passing attack that it's going to take to win deep in the playoffs games in December, in Minnesota, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, these places where you have to go through to get to Virginia, to be honest with you, to get to the national championship game in Division III. And Saturday was really a perfect example of that kind of day. It was snowing in Minnesota. You were lucky to get out of there and get down to that North Central game. I know from you tweeting and telling me your travel tales, but it was, you know, there was snow on the ground for this game. There was, you know, 5,000 people in the stands at O'Shaughnessy Stadium on the campus of St. Thomas, very close to Bethel, you know, about 8 miles away or what have you. So Bethel brings its crowd. St. Thomas brings its crowd. 8 inches of snow on the ground. What else are you going to do but run the ball and play great defense? And wasn't all that different from the first game. St. Thomas won in the regular season 10-6. Bethel wins 12-7 in the playoff game by virtue of rushing for 287 yards and then limiting St. Thomas to 220 total yards.
One of the other quarterfinal, the one that we haven't really talked about much, is Wesley defeating Mary Hardin Baylor by the score of 19-9. And you know, Keith, just another classic battle in the five game long playoff series between these two teams. But Keith, I if I remember the predictions correctly, I think we all thought it was going to be a little bit higher scoring than this one. And you know, for 19-9. Doesn't necessarily sound close on the surface, but it really wasn't that close either. It was 19-3 for more than a quarter. It was 12-3 for a long period of time as well. It just, Mary Hardin Baylor had some opportunities, but couldn't quite put it together on offense in large stretches of the game.
Yeah, Pat, you touched on it, you know, because you could look at it from either perspective. If you look at it from the Mary Hardin Baylor perspective, they had a couple of chances in the second half of this game. You know, they gave up 6 sacks in the first half, and then they you know, not necessarily a great passing team to begin with, but they were able to drive the field. And a couple times in the second half, and I think they had a fumble. You know, they blocked a punt, and then fumbled the ball back to Wesley when they had a chance to put some points on the board. And then they had a fourth and goal, and thought, I think Wesley had 12 men on the field, earned a delay of game, so instead of fourth and goal from the one, ended up being fourth and goal from the six, and they didn't get in. Those are two real squandered opportunities that in a 19-9 game, you know, those are points that really were key for Mary Harden-Baylor. And, you know, this is the first time these two teams, as tight a rivalry, I guess, as they've had over the past 6 years now, to be usually the last two teams standing in the South region. This is the first time they've played a game that was within 10 points.
Yeah, because they've usually been in the 46-36 range and that sort of thing. You know, the things you talked about there just a moment ago, the thing that stands out most to me is we're talking about a Mary Harden-Baylor team that gave up four sacks and a half. You know, there would be times when you wouldn't have four sack opportunities against Mary Harden-Baylor and a half because, you know, when a quarterback runs the ball on a designed run and if he's knocked down behind the line of scrimmage, that's not a sack. You know, these have to be passing opportunities in order for a sack to be credited, and that was, you know, just the way Mary Harden-Baylor was playing.
Well, that's what, you know, they said about Mary Harden-Baylor this year, that they'd grown up enough and they'd been deep enough in the playoffs to realize that at some point they have to have that other dimension. And it doesn't have to be a perfect balance where they pass 25 times, throw 25 times, or what have you, but they have to be able to be effective enough in the passing game to keep teams honest. And so they'd finally come to do that this year. They had a couple of real tall receiving threats, including one who was 6'5", and they were expecting a pretty big game out of him, and they didn't get that on Saturday. But they got their normal big game out of Quincy Daniels. He rushed for 156 yards. So Mary Harden-Baylor, you know, they were held to 239 total yards, which is 260 below their average. They were averaging almost 500 yards of offense. But still, they had a chance to win this game because their defense kept Wesley honest. And Wesley was 140 yards and 25 points below its regular average. And so it was sort of much more of a defensive game, I guess, than anyone expected. And even I know my triple take prediction was something of a defensive game. I think I said like 20-15. But it was even more defensive than that. And I think if we can take one thing away going forward here next week when Wesley has to play Whitewater, it's that, especially if Whitewater's missing its starting quarterback, and you know, Wesley's been playing with its second best quarterback the entire season now, so now their best quarterback is their second best quarterback. But Wesley has lost as many as 11 guys that they feel like would have made the playoff roster, and then they lost four more guys. They kicked off the team between rounds 2 and 3 for something they did off campus. So now they don't have all their offensive weapons. So if you have a great defense and a pretty decent running game, which they do with Brandon Wright, you're going to see Wesley try to lean on that, try to establish itself a little bit against Whitewater. And Whitewater, same thing. If Matt Blanchard isn't healthy or he can't go, we'll see Whitewater do what has got them this far, which is play great defense and then lean on Lavelle Coppedge late in games.
Let's talk about the four guys arrested for Wesley for a minute. On campus, but off the field, of course, the reason why those four guys didn't play. At least I thought, you know, as disappointing as that incident is, Wesley, from a football standpoint, took quick, decisive action. And, you know, I hate to be a cynic, but I'd have to think that, you know, there are probably, 50-60 programs that play NCAA football at which those guys would have been in uniform on Saturday and maybe sat out a quarter or a half and still gotten to play in the game.
Yeah, no, I think you hit it right on the head, Pat, that as it doesn't reflect well on the program at all. And you know, Wesley's one of those programs where it's very easy to find a way to knock them, you know, because of the kind of kids that they're able to recruit. They don't have the same limitations as some schools do in terms of whether it's test scores or roster size. So it's easy to try to knock Wesley, but I think they did the right thing. Bang. They took care of it. No, none of these halfway punishments. You know, they said if you get involved in something like that, that's off the field and it's criminal. You're not representing what Division III is supposed to represent, and you're not playing for the rest of the season. You're done. And these were guys who, weren't necessarily Wesley stars, but it was a starting tight end. It was really one of their best downfield threats as a wide receiver, a guy who played as a safety. So it wasn't like they were throwing nobodies off the team. I mean, if you make the playoff roster, you know, there's only 52 guys on your playoff roster, and programs like all these playoff programs are 100 guys or more. You take, you know, some four of your best 52 guys off, you know, you're going to have to bring some guys up. And I think that's where Wesley's depth certainly helps them. And, especially with the injuries they've had to overcome this season, it's reflected well on them. And it goes back to them being this deep as a semifinalist, you know, in 05 and 06. And you recruit off of those deep playoff appearances, and then you have the depth the next time you need it. So it's worked out great for Wesley. And even though, as you look ahead to this Wolverines-Warhawks matchup, you know, it's hard to figure out what's stylistically real different from these two teams from the first two times where Whitewater won big, you know, 58-6 and 44-7, I believe, were the scores back in 05 and 06. The first 2 years, Whitewater went to the Stag Bowl, met Wesley in this exact same round. A couple things are different. The game this time is in Dover, Delaware, so Whitewater is going to have to come on the road. It's a big trip from Wisconsin, obviously, to Delaware. And then another big difference is Lance Leipold wasn't the coach of the Warhawks the last two times these two teams met. So even though it was only a few years ago, and there's some similarities, I think, stylistically between the teams, there could be some differences.
And you know, after the game I was at was over, the Whitewater North Central game, obviously, Whitewater people knew what was ahead of them. It was a trip to Wesley, so there was a fair amount of discussion about Whitewater Wesley the first two times around. And I'll say a couple things about, you know, taking the pulse at least of the fan base and, you know, some alumni, including people who had suited up for the Warhawks, who were at the game, their take on the first couple meetings and then how that relates to this time around. First of all, I don't think there's anybody who was really there and has a really informed opinion who doesn't think that Wesley's going to give a much stronger representation this time around than they did in 2005 and 2006. And I think one of the perceptions, or it may not even be a perception, but one of the things that Wesley needs to overcome that really plagued them the first couple times around is, you know, from all reports, when Wesley got down in a hole early, they just kind of packed it in. And the, you know, as players, you got to be able to accept that kind of adversity on the field. Certainly Wesley has been through some non-in-game adversity this season, shall we say. And then they've lost, of course, some of their top guys, as you mentioned a few minutes ago. But, you know, to get when you get punched in the mouth early in a football game, in a big game against a good team, you got to be able to summon some inner strength and go back out there and fight to get back into the game. And that's one of the things that Wesley was missing in the first two meetings against Whitewater. And if Whitewater comes out and does the same thing on Saturday in the upcoming national semifinals, Wesley's going to have to be able to deal with it differently than they did the first two times.
You know, Pat, those are all great points. You know, Wesley has, on the field, been tested. You know, played Delaware Valley close, played Salisbury close, had to play, you know, dig deep to beat Mary Harden Baylor this past week. So, you know, they've got three close games under their belt. So just as we praised earlier in the podcast Whitewater for having to pass these tests in the second half, you know, Wesley is pretty well tested as well. But, Pat, you're right. I ask myself, what's really different about this Wesley team than the previous Wesley teams that played Whitewater, that went there and frankly, you know, got dominated, got pushed around on the line, and I thought prior to both those games that Wesley had the defensive line at least to try to deal with the Warhawks offensive line, and that wasn't really the case in either of the games. And you know, there's some different backstories to the games. Again, you know, you say that Wesley got down and wasn't able to come back. You know, there was weather was a factor, maybe the footing was a factor for Wesley for the first time, but the results were convincing. You know, Whitewater was clearly the better team both times. So what's different about Wesley this time? And it's got to be something intangible.
Right.
You know, whether it's the coaching is different, whether it's, you know, they dig deep. And this is a team, you're right, that's been through some adversity. You know, they also had a personal tragedy happen to them during the season, and I don't know if that's something that I should bring up on the podcast or not, but as far as talking about a team that has strength, you know, they've lived through injuries, they've lived through this kind of adversity, and they've done it on the field, that maybe that does lead us to believe that this team has the fortitude, you might say, to be able to deal with Whitewater. And then, of course, they play at home too.
And you know, I think you hit the nail on the head there too, as well. Whatever the difference is for Wesley this time around, it has to be something that we can't see, because they continue to be talented. They continue to have size. You know, they need to you know, some of the knocks against the team in the past have been, you know, I hesitate to say mental toughness, but you know, where they got down in the game and couldn't mentally battle themselves back, and then discipline, and those have been the traditional knocks recently against Wesley, and those aren't necessarily things that you see when two teams line up across from each other. The other national semifinal is a matchup we've seen before. Bethel gets a return trip to Alliance, Ohio, to take on Mount Union. And, you know, Bethel was there in 2007. Starting running back was the same. So, you know, Logan Flannery at least knows what it's like to play at Alliance. And like a lot of teams that go to Alliance, Bethel knows what it's like to be dominated as well.
Yeah, that game in 2007 was 62-14, Pat, and I was there, and I think you were there with me.
Yes,
we've been to Mount Union so many times in the playoffs over the years. I forget who was alongside me for some of these games, but it wasn't a terribly fun game to watch, and it was kind of disappointing because Bethel had been on such a nice run that year. They had upset Central in the snow the week before, and that was one of the all-time fun playoff games. You know, anytime you have the snow game and you have two historically good programs meet, you get excited about that game. And then the next week you think it's going to be another good game. And in some of these semifinals, you know, that year in 07, it was 62-14. And I guess that was the 40, I don't know, what was that? Maybe that was a Mary Hardin-Baylor semifinal. But in any case, some of the semifinals have been, you know, disappointing over the years. And you look at these four teams that we have now this year, and you think, wow, this Whitewater Wesley game could be a great game, could be another disappointment. And Mount Union Bethel, you always assume Mount Union is going to win and maybe win going away, but there's reason to believe Bethel could make this an interesting game because their strengths match up, I think, perfectly. You know, Mount Union really this season is a defensive team. And because they gave up 20 points to 28 points to Wisconsin Oshkosh in the opener, it's been, you know, we've oft said that they have a little bit of a weakness this year, but they've been great on defense ever since then. They gave up 54 total points the rest of the season, had, you know, six shutouts or something like that. They've given up 10 points in three playoff games. Okay, so they're dominating good teams now. So defensively, you know, Bethel not going to be able to score a lot of points, but doesn't matter because they're not a team that runs up a whole bunch of points. They're perfectly comfortable playing a close game, defense, field position, running game. You know, they won 12-7 on Saturday. Logan Flannery had 38 carries for 200 yards. If he has to get 38 more carries for them to beat Mount Union, that's fine because that's Bethel style. And I think, to be quite honest, you know, this isn't the one of the great Mount Union teams. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's not one of the most star-studded Mount Union teams where they just overwhelm you with how talented they are. But if there's anything we've learned about Mount Union over the years, there's two things that really stand out. One, they play really well as a team, and they're deep. You know, just because they don't have any superstar standouts or many superstar standouts doesn't mean they have any weaknesses. And the other thing that we've learned over the years, Pat, is that if Larry Karras knows he has a good team, he keeps something in the back pocket for when he needs to break it out. And if they get in trouble against Bethel, you know, there's something that we haven't seen Mount Union do this year that they probably can do. And whether it's trick plays, whether it's, you know, using Cecil Shorts as the quarterback, or, you know, running Nate Kamik a whole bunch of times so they don't, you know, have to use Pierre Garçon a whole bunch, or they don't have to use the passing game. I mean, there are historical instances of Mountain Union breaking out a new wrinkle in the semifinals or in the Stag Bowl to beat a team where they really need to beat them. And we know Larry Karras is also the master of in-game adjustments and in-season adjustments. So even if it turns out to be a good game and Mountain Union isn't able to move the ball on Bethel a whole lot, there's something in that up that sleeve that we haven't seen yet.
The ultimate example of that, I think, is bringing out Greg McKaylee in the second half of the Stag Bowl. Oh, and by the way, he is this wonderful, multi-talented quarterback who might well be the best quarterback of the decade in Division III football for all the discussion. Something that Whitewater couldn't have prepared for because it didn't exist on film. He'd never done anything like that in any of the games that he played in previously. Here's the thing about Bethel Mountain Union that worries me from a Bethel standpoint is, you're right, Bethel is comfortable and confident in playing in low scoring games. I don't see them beating Mountain Union 12-7. I don't see them holding Mountain Union to 7 points. Bethel scoring 12 points, may not be out of the realm of possibility. It certainly wouldn't be 4 field goals. The kicking game has been all but abandoned. They did attempt a field goal on Saturday to try to take the 5-point game to an 8-point game, but it was missed, and they never bothered to attempt a traditional 1-point conversion. They missed on two 2-point conversions. I just don't see Bethel scoring enough. I see Bethel holding Mountain Union down defensively. And moving the chains and keeping the clock moving a little bit, but they're a little one dimensional on offense as well. They don't throw the ball well enough, and I don't see that being enough diversity to move the ball against Mountain Union, frankly.
Well, Mountain Union is already exceptional on defense to begin with. They give you this 4-2-5 look, which not a whole lot of teams have seen during the season, and the cool thing about the 4-2-5 is it can sort of, because you play with these with a weak safety and a strong safety and a free safety, it can morph into whatever you want it to be. It can be a 4-4 look, it can be a 4-3 look, and you saw this game on DVR with Mountain Union where they have a stand up end, so it's almost like a 3-4 look, and so you give a lot of looks to the offense, so it's already going to be tough as it is for Bethel to move the ball. But I think maybe this will be, for the Royals, the greatest test of Logan Flannery's leadership ability, because he was the one who played for them a whole bunch in 07. Coach Steve Johnson, and if he has any other seniors that played a big role in 07, it's weird. They're going to have to draw on that experience and try to find a way to say, hey, we might have lost 62-14, but that was a whole nother time, but yet we got something out of that game that proved we belong at this level. So they're going to have to kind of psych themselves up somehow, to either say, this is a new year, forget about that history, don't be scared to go to Alliance. Some way they're going to have to psych themselves up into believing they belong. And I think, they've played well together this year. They've overcome, obviously, the only team that beat them all season, they turned around and beat them in the playoffs. So they're certainly a mentally tough team, and they're going to have to be, I think, to win in Alliance.
First time around, Logan Flannery ran 19 times for 51 yards. Jared Bangs, who was a fullback for Bethel in 2007, 10 carries for 49 yards. The game started out 55-0. Bethel got two scores in the fourth quarter to get off the get the goose egg off the scoreboard. Other than that, notable in the fourth quarter, Cecil Shorts scoring on a 28-yard touchdown run, and that was when he was the number two quarterback, and that was primarily the only time he got playing time for the Purple Raiders.
I mean, I think if you couldn't ask for too much better of a Final Four. I mean, you're looking at the consensus 3 best teams pretty much since the start of the season. And if St. Thomas had gone through against Bethel, it would be maybe the consensus top 4. Mary Hardin Baylor and North Central round out the teams that have been the top 6 teams in the poll since about midway through the season. So I think you had really as good a semifinal round as you could ask for. You know, you certainly could have tried to stick, you know, Linfield or Ohio Northern or some other teams in there if you wanted to have the perfect Final Eight. But you're really looking at a Final Four that is the three best teams in the country, or the three highest ranked teams in the country, and then a team that played two even games with number four team in the country and beat them, you know, on their home field. So for Bethel, strength wise, you know, you can't ask for much more. And I think the only thing that would have made it more interesting is what almost happened. If St. Thomas would have won that game, Mount Union would have had to travel to St. Thomas, and they lucked out. Bethel won, and Mount Union is at home. Whitewater is on the road, and if for some reason you're listening to an hour of our podcast yet you don't know this history, Mount Union and Whitewater, five straight meetings in the Stag Bowl, and headed toward a sixth if they both win on Saturday.
Indeed. If that's news to you, I appreciate you following through all this, because you have sat through a lot, and still being, I guess, having been under a rock for Division III football, if you didn't know at least some of that. So we're on to the national semifinals. Two games on Saturday, both of which will be covered by a video on NCAA.com. I do know, as of this hour on Sunday night, I can confirm, well, I think Keith knows this, that Gordon Mann and Keith McMillan will be calling the game between Whitewater and Wesley at Wesley on Saturday at noon for NCAA.com, and then NCAA.com will also be doing video of the Mount Union Bethel game. So those games will be running simultaneously. I'm going to be sitting here in the office with two screens side by side, and you know, again, Mount Union for only the second time in this playoff structure lucks out and ducks a potential opportunity to have to go on the road. The year that they lost the regular season game back in 2005, they were seeded to where they would have to have gone on the road if Rowan had lost to Delaware Valley in the quarterfinals in the East region. Instead, Rowan wins that game. They're the lower seed. They travel to Alliance. Similarly, this year, Mount Union would have had to travel if St. Thomas had won, but St. Thomas lost, and Bethel has to travel to Alliance, Ohio. So we will bring you more, of course, from the world of Division III football, the playoffs. All region teams come out this week, so check back midweek for those and everything else that goes on between here and Salem. For Keith McMillan, I'm Pat Coleman, and that's the Around the Nation podcast, Under an Hour.